Okay, Dr. Sokolow, as we begin, I guess the newsman, officially the newsman, how Tanakh, let's put together the Tanakh and biblical interpretation. That's where we're up to. Vakasha.
Very good. Good evening to everybody. So just to catch us up, we're into our third session on the subject of Parshanot, for which, of course, the proper British word exegesis is the technical term. We started with a general survey of what we expectations are of biblical interpretation. And then last week, we started to look at individual commentators. Last week, we started with the Talmud, and we saw that the Talmud introduced the phrase, Ein mikra yotzei midei pshuto, which I translated as no verse can be purged of its literal sense. And that idea that pshuto shel mikra, the literal sense of a verse, can never be entirely dismissed, is essentially at the heart of 2,000 years of biblical interpretation. The question is not whether a verse can have both a literal sense and a non-literal sense. Certainly, there are verses that need to be taken literally, and there are equally verses that cannot be taken literally. The question is just, what are the criteria? How do we distinguish between verses whose literal sense can be sustained and those whose literal sense needs to be replaced by some sort of figurative, allegorical, or metaphorical interpretation? So last week, we looked at some of the advice given to biblical commentators by some of the very earliest exegetes, particularly Saadia Gaon and Shmuel Bar Chofni, who lived during the 10th and early part of the 11th centuries. This evening, we're going to move from the Middle East to Northern Europe, and we're going to begin with Rashi. I don't know whether we'll get as far as Rashbam this evening, but we'll certainly be able to do a thorough exploration of Rashi. So the first thing that you noticed is that I have subtitled this evening's class, The Quest for Peshat. As I just explained, it's exactly that. That the history of biblical interpretation is the attempt to establish objective criteria for which verses, as I said, can be sustained in their literal sense and which need to be interpreted. Okay. Notice also that between Rashi and Rashbam, I placed the word Rashi in Hebrew characters, and I used a particular kind of Hebrew font, one which has come to be known as Ketav Rashi, although I must tell you now that even though it's called Ketav Rashi, it's not because Rashi either invented it or even because Rashi used it, because Rashi neither invented nor, for that matter, did Rashi even use what's called Ketav Rashi, Rashi script. It's called Rashi script, even though Rashi never used it, simply because the earliest printing of Rashi used this typeface. It used this font. The earliest printed edition of Rashi, in fact, the earliest Hebrew book, printed Hebrew book, to have a date was an edition of Rashi's commentary on the Torah that was printed in the Italian city of Reggio di Calabria in 1475. When I say that this is the first printed Hebrew book to carry a date, I'm distinguishing between what we call printed books and what are called by scholars incunabula. Incunabula are books. Physically, they're no different from the printed books that have dates. The difference is that when printing was first introduced, it had not yet become habitual to put down the date or even necessarily the place in which the books were being printed. So there are in existence any number of books that were printed without dates. Those books are called incunabula. When they started putting dates, attaching dates to printed books, that is when we first find the first printed Hebrew book. And as I said, that first printed Hebrew book with a date is the commentary of Rashi on the Torah. Okay. Going back now. So as I said, because the typeface that was used for that edition of Rashi became the standard for subsequent editions of Rashi, it came to be known as the Rashi script. The assumption that it's called the Rashi script because it's a script that Rashi used is unfortunately erroneous. Okay. Rashi, who was born in 1040 and died in 1105, is unquestionably, I called him the brightest star in the firmament of traditional biblical exegesis. I was waxing eloquent a bit. The acronym Rashi that makes up his name has been decoded alternatively as Rabban Shel Yisrael, the teacher of Israel par excellence, and the Hasidic tradition, I believe it's attributed to the Kotzke Rebbe, names Rashi as Achiha Shel Toratenu HaKedosha, the brother, as it were, of the Holy Torah. And interestingly, almost as many commentaries to Rashi's commentary, and that's why they're called super commentaries, because they are commentaries to an existing commentary. Almost as many super commentaries have been written to the commentary of Rashi as have been written to the Torah itself. The list, which was actually prepared in 1940 to mark the millennium of Rashi's birth, runs well beyond 300, and it was not a complete list. Now, we should just, before we get to Rashi himself, we should understand where Rashi's labors in the field of biblical interpretation were similar to and where they are distinct from those of his predecessors. So since, at least at the moment, the only ones of Rashi's predecessors whom we have mentioned are Saadia Gaon and Shmuel Bar Chofni, we'll take a moment just to distinguish Rashi from Saadia. And there are a number of, and I've simply singled out, four of the principal distinctions between them. The first is that whereas Saadia Gaon wrote his commentaries within the cultural and intellectual framework of the Arabic Muslim world, Rashi wrote his within the context of medieval Christianity. So where you expect Islam to have had an influence on the Jews living in its orbit, you can understand why commentaries that were written there would be different from those that were written in places in which Jews were subject to the influences of Christianity. For example, where Saadia was acquainted with the literary and scientific accomplishments of the Muslim world, which in the High Middle Ages were numerous, right? We call one aspect of mathematics algebra simply because it was introduced by Arabs, right? The prefix al is the Arabic equivalent of the hey hayadiya, of the definite article the. Jabr is ultimately something great, something large, or something complex. Hence, that particular branch of mathematics is called algebra precisely because it was introduced by Arabs. So whereas Saadia was acquainted with literary and scientific accomplishments of the Arab civilization, and they are reflected throughout his work, Rashi's approach to Tanakh was focused more on traditional Jewish sources and ideas. Therefore, whereas Saadia could draw on an extensive religious philosophical literature in order to treat questions of biblical theology, Rashi had no access to works of philosophy in any language, and therefore he was restricted to the use of Talmud and Midrash. And finally, whereas Saadia could draw upon the philological insights of Arabs and Jews in the Middle East and North Africa, And in fact, the earliest works of Hebrew grammar and philology were written during the late 9th, 10th, and early 11th centuries, usually in Arabic, by Jews living in the Middle East, North Africa, or in Muslim Spain. Rashi, who knew no Arabic, could only use the older and by the 12th century outdated works of Menachem ben Saruk and Dunash ibn Labrat. Here we have the passage that I shared with you at the very end of last week's class, and that I invited you to help me to decipher by looking up the source of one of Rashi's, of one of the phrases that Rashi uses here. However, I decided first to share it with you in Ketav Rashi. So here, in fact, is this phrase as I copied it from the earliest printed edition of Rashi's commentary on the Torah. And we're going to try to read it. Okay. The truth is that out of 24 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, or if you wish, out of 27 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, if you include the final letters, all but four are nearly indistinguishable from their ordinary Hebrew counterparts. So truly, mastering Ketav Rashi is not really difficult. Okay? In fact, the advice that I give to teachers is not to invest in these expensive workbooks that many Jewish publishing houses have produced, in which children have exercises and they draw pictures and they copy letters. All you need to do is type a sentence in Hebrew using an ordinary Hebrew font, copy it, paste it, then highlight the copy and switch the font from an ordinary Hebrew font to the Rashi script. And then students can see the same Hebrew sentence, one above the other, in ordinary Hebrew script and in the so-called Rashi script, and see very quickly, as I said, that there are really all but four really drastic differences. So here is the text, and I'll read it, and then I'll replace it with a slide that has the text both in English as well as in an ordinary Hebrew font. The first word, Vayishma'u, is the word in the biblical text which Rashi is addressing. The verse is Genesis, Bereshit, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Chet, third chapter, eighth verse, which says about Adam and Eve that they were strolling in the Garden of Eden during Ruach Hayom, during the time of the day in which it was windy. Vayishma'u et kol Hashem Elokim yitalech bagan l'ruach hayom. And there, and in the garden, they heard, right, the sound or the voice of God. So Rashi's comment is apropos of the word vayishma'u that they heard. And Rashi says as follows, yesh midrashei agada rabim, that there are indeed numerous midrashic interpretations of this verse and of other verses. Uchvar sidrum rabotenu al mechonam, and the rabbis have already arranged these midrashic interpretations in their proper places. Bivreshit rabba, I'm now on the first word of the second line. Bivreshit rabba uvshaar midrashot. Where are these midrashim arranged? They're arranged in midrashic anthologies, of which perhaps the best known one, certainly to the book of Genesis, is called Bereshit Rabba. Okay? Then you can see kind of like a dot following the third word on the second line. Maybe it's a period. Maybe it's just a speck of dirt. Okay? But from here on in is a new sentence. And Rashi says of himself, Va'ani. Right? Whereas I. Whereas is to establish a contrast. The contrast is between the rabbis who arranged midrashic interpretations of the Torah and Rashi, because Rashi calls himself HaMefaresh. Right? Rashi calls himself an interpreter. So Rashi tells us that whereas the rabbis were satisfied in just anthologizing midrashic comments and arranging them in the order of biblical verses, Rashi, as let's say a professional commentator, has a different objective in mind. And what is his objective? He says, Va'ani lo vati lefaresh ella. Remember that every time we have a combination of a negative, lo, and the preposition ella, other or rather, right? The combination produces only. Lo this, ella that means only that. Okay? So Rashi says that I, the commentator, have come only lipshuto shel mikra. The identical phrase that we saw in that passage from the Talmud dealing with the laws of Shabbat. Pshuto shel mikra, the literal sense of a verse. But he doesn't stop there. He says, ooh, right? That's not so much the exclamation as it is with the conjunction. And, right? And, meaning there's a second part to Rashi's objective as a commentator. And that is what he calls Agada Hamiyashevet Al Divrei Mikra, Hamikra. An agada, that's a form of midrash, that settles, liashev, like lashevet, to settle down, divrei hamikra. Okay? It means that if the language of a verse is unsettled, right? Then Rashi, as a commentator, needs to find something that will settle it down. Okay? So Rashi's first choice in settling the language of a verse is what he calls pshuto shel mikra, determining its literal sense. And an alternative way of settling the language of a biblical verse is by means of a midrash, by means of an agadah. Now, if you take a look here, you'll see a slightly different version of what I just read. That's because, as I said, partially a result of the fact that there are so many manuscripts and so many printed editions of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, that it is very difficult, not impossible, but very difficult on occasion to determine just which of the many different texts is the most correct one. Okay? So here, for example, you see that it doesn't have the word hamefaresh. It just says va'ani lo vati. Rashi doesn't, here in this version, doesn't refer to himself specifically as a commentator, although obviously that's implicit. Okay. So what Rashi then does, and this is where I left you last week, he ends this comment, this description of his methodology, right? The one that says that in order to settle a biblical verse, in order to resolve difficulties in the biblical text, Rashi says that he will make use of two different methodologies, one of which he calls Pshuto Shel Mikra, and the other he calls Agada HaMiyashevet Divrei Mikra. Then he concludes this statement with what I told you last week, is half a pasuk. Davar, a word, davor, spoken, al ofnav. And ofan literally is either the axle of a car or it's something around which something revolves or something on which something rotates. Okay. But here it's generally translated as the context. Meaning, here's the verse, the full verse. Tapuche zahav, golden apples, b'maskiot kasef, in silver trays, serving pieces, show pieces, Davar davor al ofnav, so is a well-turned phrase or a word fitly spoken. So, first of all, tapuchei zahav are not oranges. Okay, with all due deference to Eliezer ben Yehuda or the Akademia Lalashon HaYivrit, I understand why they came up with tapuchei zahav as the modern Hebrew designation for oranges, but there were no oranges in Israel during the biblical period. Okay, difficult to determine whether there were any citrus fruits that were native to the land of Israel. Right? Think about it. From a Jewish perspective, the most important and certainly the most famous citrus fruit, right? It's not a Jaffa orange, right? Is an etrog. And the mere fact that the name etrog is Persian, right, should be a pretty good indication that it's not a native Jewish plant. Okay. As a matter of fact, oranges are actually native to the Iberian Peninsula. Right? In fact, I can give you two proofs for that. Both are linguistic. One is, if you know what the Spanish word is for an orange, okay, it's naranja. Okay? N-A-R-A-N-J-A. It looks like narange. Okay? What's the relationship between, listen carefully, an orange and a narange? The relationship is that when the oranges first came to England, right, they were called naranges, right? It was after the Spanish or Portuguese word for it. However, there was already a place in England that was called Orange for a completely different reason, because of William of Orange, one of the early conquerors. Okay. So what happened is that when the Norange came to England, there was a sound shift. And instead of saying a Norange, they started saying an orange. And that's how we here in the United States came to call it oranges rather than Norranges. The second linguistic proof is from Arabic. When oranges were first imported into the Middle East from the Iberian Peninsula, right? What did they call them? And I'll tell you what an orange is called in Arabic to this very day. The Arabic word for orange is Portugal. And if it sounds like the word Portugal, that's exactly what it is. Oranges were basically called those things that we import from Portugal. So when Sefer Mishlei talks about tapuchei zahav, it's not talking about oranges, it's talking about golden apples. And it doesn't mean a golden apple in the sense that we have golden delicious apples. That would mean a brand of apple that happens to have a golden hue to its skin. Rather, it literally means, we're not even sure that tapuchim means apples for that matter. The fact in Shir HaShirim, we have references to tapuach, tacha tapuach, or artiha, and things like that. There is no certainty, as far as I know, amongst Israeli botanists and the like, that the biblical word tapuach even means what we call an apple. It's clearly something round, and it may well not just be something round, but even something that grows and is round. But the tapuchei zahav here quite likely are nothing more than literally golden apples. That is to say, orbs, some circular kinds of things that were either made of gold or that were gilded. Now, what happens when you take something that is either made of gold or is covered with gold and you place it on a silver tray? By the way, even in English to this very day, you would think, wouldn't you, that if gold fetches a higher price per ounce on the commodities market than silver, that we would talk about people being born with a golden spoon in their mouth. but we still talk about a silver spoon because it isn't so much the value of gold and silver as precious metals, right? As determined by, as I said, by the commodities index, as it is just simply a figure of speech. So it doesn't matter that they're placed on a silver tray, they could be placed on a golden tray. The point is that if you take something that has an inherent value and you display it, as it were, or you place it in the context of something else that has a significant value, then you have enhanced its value. So the value of Tapuach Zahav is enhanced when the Tapuach Zahav is displayed on a maskiot kesef, on a silver showpiece. Now, to what is that analogous? That is analogous, says Rashi, to davar davor al ofnav. That is to say, that if you have what we call in Yiddish a good vort, right, a not good idea, right, or something that you want to give articulation to, something you want to express. If you give expression to that idea in a suitable context, rather than in no context whatsoever, then effectively you have enhanced its value. It has an inherent value, just as the golden apples have an inherent value, but that value can be enhanced depending upon the context in which it is placed. So what did Rashi mean when he said, let's go back, what did Rashi mean when he said that he would use an agadah to resolve a textual difficulty? Davar davor al ofnav. I understand that to mean as follows. What is analogous to the tapuche zahav? The agadot. Rashi says that agadot, midrashic statements, have inherent value. They have an inherent value by virtue of the fact that they were recited by the sainted rabbis, by Chazal. However, says Rashi, something that even has an inherent value can still have that value enhanced, provided it's placed in the proper context. So when Rashi says that he will use agadot to resolve textual difficulties, Rashi calls that davar davor alofnav, a word fitly spoken or a well-turned phrase, to mean that amongst all of the agadot, amongst all of the midrashim that the rabbis have collected, he will be selective. And he will use only those agadot that contribute to the resolution of biblical difficulties. And that is to say, the fact that they will help to resolve a difficult biblical text, that is the equivalent of the maskiot kesef, that is the equivalent of displaying them on a silver tray. Rashi makes pretty much the same statement of objective in his introduction to Shir HaShirim. And it's interesting that Shir HaShirim is the only one of the 24 books of the Bible to which Rashi wrote an introduction. Okay? And it's probably because Rashi, under the influence of rabbinic interpretation, was persuaded that Shir HaShirim is not meant to be understood literally, but it is meant to be understood as an allegory, right? The shepherd is not a mortal shepherd. It's an allegory for God. And the shepherdess is not a mortal shepherdess, but it's an allegory representing the people of Israel. And that the relationship between the dove, the lover, and the ra'ayah, his beloved, is an allegory for the relationship between God and the people of Israel. And yet, look what Rashi says. Rashi says in the second bullet point, even though we know that prophets often spoke figuratively, let alone allegorically, Sarich liyashev hadugma. Notice again that word liyashev, to settle. Sarich liyashev hadugma. The figurative language has to be settled. Al ofne hava al sidra, depending upon its context. Kemo sha mikraot sidurim ze achar ze. Just as you cannot or you should not interpret any individual verse ignoring the verse before it and the verse following it, just as you shouldn't take a verse out of context, you shouldn't take a figure of speech out of context. But essentially what Rashi is saying is that even the allegorical content of Tanakh is effectively hostage to the literal sense. Here's an example. Okay? This will help us to illustrate just what Rashi meant when he spoke about the two alternative ways in which to resolve biblical problems. Remember that the first one he called Pshuto Shel Mikra, that is adhering to the literal sense, and the other he called Agada HaMiyashevet Divrei Mikra, a rabbinic interpretation, a midrash, so to speak, that also resolves the difficulty. Have a good look at the verse. The verse says as follows. The subject of the verse is Bat Paro, Pharaoh's daughter. And it says, Vatered Bat Paro lirchots al hayor, that Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile in order to bathe. V'na'aroteha, right, her ladies in waiting, right? Holochot al yad hayor, accompanied her along the banks of the Nile. Vateret hateva betoch hasof, whereupon Pharaoh's daughter glimpsed the box with baby Moses amongst the rushes, right, along the banks of the Nile. Vatishlachet amata vatikacheha, whereupon she dispatched her ama to retrieve it. I purposely not translated the word ama because that's the subject of Rashi's commentary. Rashi says right away, et amata et shifchata. And ama, says Rashi, is simply a synonym for a shifcha. Okay? A shifcha, a maidservant. Okay? Which of the two approaches that Rashi outlined is this one? Clearly, this is the pshuto shel mikra approach, the literal sense. And ama is a biblical Hebrew synonym for a shifcha. Therefore, says Rashi, how did Pharaoh's daughter retrieve the box with baby Moses? She sent one of her maidservants to retrieve it. Then Rashi says, V'rabotenu darshu l'shon yad. The rabbis, right, interpreted the word ama differently. They interpreted the word ama to signify her arm. So according to the rabbinic interpretation, how did Pharaoh's daughter retrieve the box with baby Moses? She stretched out her own hand and retrieved it. Okay. If this is all that Rashi had said, I could understand that since the word ama is not as prevalent in biblical Hebrew as the word shifcha, Rashi was perhaps troubled by its use here, and therefore he offered his two interpretations of it. One says, even though it's an unusual word, it's not a rare word, I know what it means, I looked it up in the dictionary, it's just an ordinary synonym for shifcha. While the other interpretation says, well, you know, if you look carefully in the dictionary, there are two words that are spelled aleph mem he. And whereas one of them means, is a synonym for a shifcha, the other aleph mem he is a synonym for an arm. Therefore, the possibility is that Pharaoh's daughter retrieved the box herself. as I say, if this is all that Rashi said, we would move on. But look what Rashi says. The very next verse in Rashi is but. Aval. What's the but? Lefi diktuk lashon hakodesh. According to the rules of Hebrew grammar, hayalo lehinaked amata mem degusha. If the word in the pasuk amata were the aleph mem he, that means an arm, it would require a dagesh in the letter mem. Is there a dagesh in the letter mem in the pasuk? No. Therefore, according to the rules of Hebrew grammar, could the word amata in this verse possibly mean her arm? No. It can only mean her maidservant. So now my question is, if Rashi knows that the rabbinic interpretation that he offered is an alternative to the pshat, has no leg to stand on, why in the world is he offering it? What's the point in offering an interpretation and then knocking the legs out from under it? So here is the key to understanding the history of the last 1,000 years of super commentaries, of attempts to understand Rashi. And essentially, over the millennium, there have emerged two schools of thought. Both these schools of thought base themselves essentially on Rashi's comment that we started with, the comment back on Breshit Paragimel Pasuk Chet, where Rashi said, the rabbis have their midrashim, but I, as a commentator, am interested in Pshuto Shel Mikra, but also something that I call Agadah HaMiyashevet Divrei Mikra. And the two schools of thought are as follows. One school of thought says, Rashi will use an Agadah only when there is no Pshat available. Meaning, Rashi's objective as a biblical commentator is to resolve difficulties. If he can resolve the difficulty through pshat means, which are essentially mostly philological means, then that's his preference. However, if he can't resolve the difficulty through pshat, he doesn't want to leave you with a problem. So if there is an Agadah that can resolve that very problem, then Rashi will share the Agadah with you. So essentially, according to this school of thought, Agadah to Rashi is plan B, right? The fallback position from Pshat. The second school of thought says, Rashi only uses Pshat. But we see here, as we see in innumerable occasions, that Rashi will deliver on a biblical verse, both the pshat and the drash. So what's the function of the drash if the pshat is the resolution, the only resolution of the textual difficulty? The second school of thought says, you can't begrudge Rashi the occasion or the opportunity to indulge himself in a good drasha. Lahagdil Torah ula ha'adira. So that when Rashi introduces a drash, it's not to resolve a textual problem, but it is to deliver some moral, ethical, religious, or spiritual message. These essentially are the two schools of interpretation of Rashi that have emerged over the millennium in which Rashi has been subjected to super commentaries. Looking at this verse and looking at Rashi's commentary on it, the first school of thought will tell you it's the pshat. That's why Rashi tells you at the beginning, Amata et Shifchata, period. The rest is merely a homily. There's some religious message, some ethical or moral message that's being delivered here. What's the ethical or moral message that's being delivered here? Again, this is my interpretation of it because Rashi didn't spell it out. But presuming that, in fact, that is the function of the Agadah here, I would imagine that Rashi sees it as follows. To say that Amata means her maid means that Pharaoh's daughter stood there on the banks of the Nile and went like this. You, bring me the box. Now, it's nice that after she had the box in her hands and discovered that it was a baby Hebrew infant, that she decided not to throw it back into the water, but to raise the child as her own. That's nice. But at that moment, right, that moment, the retrieval of the box, the salvation of Moses, was not due to the personal efforts of Pharaoh's daughter. However, if you interpret the word amata as her arm, and as it says at the very end, Rashi's interpretation of the Agadah is, shenitraveva amata amot harbe, as though her arm exceeded its usual reach, then it's a completely different story. Pharaoh's daughter sees a box. She hears an infant crying. She realizes that it must be a Hebrew infant. And what does she do? She does something very uncharacteristic for a princess. She gets her feet wet, right? She steps into the Nile and reaches out with her own arm in order to retrieve the box. That's a different moral to the same story. The other school of thought maintains that the Agadah that Rashi brings here serves the same function as the Pshat. That is to say, it's here to resolve a textual difficulty. Question, of course, is what is the textual difficulty that it's come to resolve? To which, again, my suggestion is as follows. Pharaoh's daughter, like princesses all everywheres, right, doesn't go out alone, right? She always has an entourage. The entourage of Pharaoh's daughter is referred to in the beginning of the verse. They are called Na'aroteha, her young ladies. Arguably, if what Pharaoh's daughter did was send one of these young ladies to retrieve the box, then it should have said, Vatishlach et Na'arata Vatikacheha, that she sent one of those Na'arot, one of those young ladies, to retrieve it. In which case, the problem is, why did the verse switch from the word Na'arot in the first half of the verse to the word Ama in the second half of the verse? Knowing that the word Ama means a Shifcha helps me to understand what it means, but it doesn't tell me why the verse switched usage. That perhaps is answered by the Agadah, which told me that she was called Amata in order to create a deliberate homonym so that I would actually pause and say, wait a second, was that her maid whom she sent, or was it her arm that reached out? This is a quick illustration of something else for which Rashi is particularly well known, and that is Rashi's use not only of Old French as a way in which to simply define Hebrew words for a French-speaking audience, but it's also Rashi's willingness to substitute his own cultural norms for those of the Bible in order to explain things. What we have here is Rashi on a very difficult phrase to understand in biblical Hebrew. When the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was completed, Moshe was instructed by God to initiate Aaron and his sons, the Kohanim, into the different services that they would have to provide in the Mishkan. And the term that the Torah uses for this initiation is umileta et yadam, which literally means to fill their hands. Okay. So Rashi is troubled by the fact that, I mean, literally, it means that Moses was supposed to put something in Aaron's hands. What was he supposed to put in his hands? So Rashi says, Kol miluy adayim l'shon chinuch, that every instance in the Bible of filling the hands means providing somebody with education or with training. Kshehu nechnas l'davar l'hiyot muchzak bo mioto yom v'hal'a hu miluy. That when you introduce somebody into something, a profession, an avocation, in which he is to become well-established from that day on, that process of initiation, of introduction, is called filling. And then he says, ubilshon la'az, which doesn't only mean the French language, but it means what happens in France in Rashi's lifetime, was as follows. Kshemimanin adam al pkidat davar, that when somebody was given an appointment, right, given a responsibility, noten hashalit biado, the ruler who gave him that appointment, right, somebody who gave him that responsibility, noten hashalit biado, places upon his hand beit yad shel or. Beit yad, a housing for the hand, shel or, of leather, shekorin gant bala'az, known in French as a gant, from which we get the English word gauntlet, right? It means a glove. Va'al yado, and it's by means of placing the glove in his hand, humachaziko badavar, that he invests him in this position or in this responsibility. Bikorin lo otomisira, and this presentation of the glove is called in old French reveste. Reveste is an alternate form, an obsolete form of the verb to invest rather than revest, right? Vehu milu yadayim, and that's the literal meaning of to fill the hands. Okay. It's... Okay. To finish, so I guess we probably will not get to Rashbam this evening, I want to show you something that, again, that I put together that I think provides a very interesting insight into Rashi. What I have here in the next five slides are Rashi's comments to the opening verses of every one of the five books of the Torah. And I think that there is a common denominator to them, and that's what I have highlighted in yellow in each one of these passages. Rashi's comment on the opening verse of the Torah is particularly well known, so much so that until there was a point in time in which people actually thought that the Rabbi Yitzchak, whom Rashi quotes at the very beginning of his comment on the very first pasuk in the Torah, was Rashi's father. Remember that Rashi, the letters stand for Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Shlomo the son of Yitzchak. And for a very, very long time, people thought that this Rabbi Yitzchak was Rashi's father. But it turns out to no, it was a scholar of the Mishnah, a Tana named Rabbi Yitzchak. But nevertheless, the fact that Rashi decided to start his commentary on the Torah with a passage that is attributed to the Tana Rabbi Yitzchak, when his own father's name was Yitzchak, is also significant. No less significant, I would argue. Nevertheless, Rabbi Yitzchak asked an interesting rhetorical question. He said, after all, he said, these five books are called the Torah. The meaning of the word Torah is instructions. So why does the Torah not begin with an instruction? The Torah should have begun, the Torah is a book of instructions, should have begun with the very first instruction that was given to the Jewish people, the instruction about sanctifying the new moon and sanctifying the month of Nisan, which would lead up to the first celebration of Pesach. This was part of last week's Torah reading. Therefore, he asks, Matam patach bibreshit. So why, in fact, does the Torah, a book of instructions, begin all the way back with creation? Mishum koach ma'asav higid la'amo latet lahem nachalat goyim. In order to inform us of God's might, God's power, and that God used his might and his power to apportion the earth amongst the various peoples, and to assign the land of Israel to the people of Israel. Kol ha'aretz shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the whole earth belongs to God who created it. Huvra'a unetana la'asher yashar be'enav. And God, as the owner of the earth, had the prerogative to allocate it to whomever he chose, and he chose to allocate it to us. So the first comment that Rashi makes on the Torah is one that addresses the special relationship between the land of Israel and the people of Israel. Here's Rashi on the first verse in the book of Shemot, in which Rashi says, wait a second. The Torah, Breshit, just ended with a list of all of the names of the 70 people who accompanied Jacob when he went down to Egypt. And that was only read last week, right? So to speak, right? So you think I forgot it already? Afa pishem na'an b'chayehen b'shmotan, says Rashi, the reason that the Torah starts Sefer Shmot once again with a list of the names of Yaakov's children is lehodia chibatan, to tell us about the special relationship between the people of Israel and the God of Israel. That on account of God's love for the Jewish people, he constantly, as it were, takes them out and counts them in order to know how many there are. The beginning of Sefer Vayikra offers Rashi a slightly different opportunity to make yet another distinctive and characteristic comment. And that is, why does God summon Moshe with the word Vayikra? After all, this isn't the first time that God has spoken to Moses. God has spoken to Moses innumerable times already in the book of Shemot. And in every single time that God speaks to Moses, it says, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor. Why now all of a sudden is it going from Vayedaber to Vayikra? So Rashi once again suggests that that is an indication of a special relationship. Lushon Chiba. Here again at the beginning of the book of Bimidbar. Book of Midbar, you may remember from a previous conversation of ours, was known in the Mishnah as Chumash HaPikudim, the book of the census, because the Jewish people are counted not once, but actually twice in the book of Bimidbar. So once again, Rashi is addressing the question of why does God have to keep counting them? And he comes up again with the same answer, mitoch chibatan lefanav moneh otam kol sha'ah, that on account of the special relationship between God and the Jewish people, he is constantly counting them, Kshatzumi Mitzrayim Mina'an, when they left Egypt, they were counted. Kshenaflu Ba'egel Mina'an, when there was the plague after, not the plague, when there was the punishment of those who worshipped the golden calf, right? They were counted once again, Leidam Minyan HaNotarim, in order to know how many survived. Kshabala Hashrot Shechinato Aleihem Mina'an, when God was about to rest, to settle his presence on the Mishkan, he counted them. Okay. And finally, and his comment on the very beginning of the book of Devarim. The Midrash says that the places that are mentioned in the first verse of the book of Devarim are actually not proper names, but they are figurative names that designate places in where during the 40-year wandering in the wilderness, the Jewish people angered God and upset him by acting poorly. Therefore, there's nothing Rashi can do to change that. He can't change that into Lashon Chiba, right, into an indication of a special relationship. Yet nevertheless, Rashi somehow still manages to turn it about by saying, L'fi shehen divrei tochechot, precisely because these are words of rebuke, Umanakan kol hamakomot shechisu lefnei hamakom bahem, and the enumeration is of all of the locations in the wilderness in which they angered God, v'chach, it was precisely for that reason, satam et hadivarim v'hizkiram beremez. The Torah didn't mention those places by their proper names, but rather it only alludes to them indirectly. Why? Mipnei kvodan shel Yisrael. Not chiba in this case, but at least kvodan shel Yisrael, in order to preserve the honor of the Jewish people. So I think, as I said, that there is this common denominator to Rashi's opening interpretations to each of the five books of the Torah that speak volumes about Rashi, the man, as well as Rashi, the commentator. And we'll stop here, and we will pick up next week with Rashbam. Let me see quickly what I can do here with some or all of these. Rashi did not make wine. There is absolutely no evidence, not historical nor literary, that Rashi made wine. Rashi sold wine, right? That was one of the occupations of Jews in Northern Europe, sold wine not just to Jews, but to Christians as well. But so far as I know, and I believe that the world's leading authority on the subject of Rashi and winemaking, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, is of the same opinion. I shouldn't say he's of the same opinion. I am of the same opinion as him, that, as I said, there is no evidence that Rashi was a winemaker, yet Rashi did, however, deal in wines as a commercially. Now, algebra is an Arabic word, not Persian. I can't change the language. It may mean assembly of pieces. That's perfectly all right. But algebra is Arabic. Okay. Yeah, whatever it is. I don't know what this comes from medieval Arabic, whatever it is. Muhtasaf Hasab al Jabr, right? The compendium on calculation, whatever it is. Okay. Radical Library, Treasure Trove, don't know exactly what that is in reference to. Isn't the origin? No, citrus, I said, as far as I know, oranges, I don't know about other citrus fruits. I don't know where lemons come from. I don't know, but I do know that oranges originated on the Iberian Peninsula. India, as I said, that would account for the word etrog, which might be Sanskrit for all I know. Okay. You think that Rashi thinks the Torah can be deliberately ambiguous, as it seems to be with the word ama. So I don't know about the word ambiguous. I actually struggle with that, with the distinguishing between ambiguity and ambivalence. I don't know whether the Torah is deliberately ambiguous. Ambiguous would mean that the Torah deliberately wants us to be puzzled about it and doesn't want us to be able to figure it out. That's what ambiguity is. I think that the Torah is deliberately ambivalent. Ambivalent in the literal sense of having two values. The Torah may deliberately use a word that has two different values, and we might be at odds with one another as to which of those values to assign to it, but I don't think it's deliberately ambiguous, if you understand ambiguous is to mean that it's difficult to understand or even impossible to understand what it means. I think it's possible. I prefer the interpretation I gave, where the change from Na'arot to Ama is the clue. Quebec French closest extent. I don't know. I can tell you, Bechol Dor Vador, in every generation, one of the world's, if not the world's, leading expert in Old French is Jewish. That's just been a matter of fact, at least for the last 150 years that I know of, simply because the richest source of Old French words are the La'azim that were used by Rashi and his contemporaries. Georgian, all right, it's like a Portocal, it's it, I, you know, same thing, because they came from Portugal. Okay, there we
all
go.
Right, thank you. Okay, if you allow me, I'm going to share an article I wrote where I do claim the Torah is ambiguous on purpose. So if that's okay, I'm going to hit the button and you can read it and disagree or agree. I'm sorry?
Be delighted.
I know. So I just put it in. The other thing, of course, in the Chaim Soloveitchik, of course, the expert on anything to do with wine in the medieval, the expert on a lot of things. But I love the way, I'm sure you recall, how he ends his article when he discusses winemaking in France. And he says, Rashi could have been a winemaker. There's no evidence. He goes through there. Absolutely no evidence. He could have been. But for that token, he could have been an egg salesman. So in other words, yeah, maybe so wine. He explains everybody in France sold wine. That's what people did in France. Like that's the famous Tshuva the Rama has when Yainesach of Stam Yainim in the Middle Ages, Jews were drinking non-Jewish wine. We're drinking Stam Yainim. And the Rama has a very, I guess, famous and difficult Tshuva where he justifies it. And he says to the French Jews, wine was like water, the way we drink water. So it lost its status of being, you know, problematic, leading to intermarriage, etc. So everybody drank wine. Yes. Error point out Marty Lakshin, I think. Right. Marty gave that same thing on the Russian. It's a beautiful thing. I've also spoken about that, that the each one of what you just said, the beautiful interpretation of Rashi, that the five, each one of the five books is introduced to the love of the Jewish people. Okay, there's lots to do. Rashi, Rishbam, I don't know how many commentaries you want to go through. You can be here for many years. Beseder, no, it's good. It's good. I have no, many, medieval, modern, all kinds of things. Anyway, tomorrow, Shuli Mishkan begins her series, what's it called? Stones. Stones and Stories, Journey Through Biblical Archaeology, 10-part series. If you haven't registered now, that's at 12 noon, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. At 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Rabbi Moshe Shulman will be giving the Parshat HaShavuot here from Young Israel of St. Louis. And 9 a.m., please God, Friday, I'll be giving my share on the Siddur. Of course, for the Parsha and the Siddur, we'll use this same, you know, login email, the winter 2022, that, right, it's the same class, but I'll send it, you know, don't use the old things, you won't get in. I know there was at least one person when they were using the fall one. If you didn't get an email, everybody here should have gotten an email with the login before. Sometimes it goes to your junk mail, whatever, so if you can just let me know and whatever, we can try to fix it, unjunk us. But now, of course, all the sessions, even the ongoing ones, will have a slightly different password. Just instead of fall 2022, winter 2022, and then you can click the link. Okay, so that's, I think those who've been here regularly know that as we change sessions and we keep sort of the new and the old come together. Okay, Hachadasha, Hachadash, what is it? Hayashanti Tit Kadesh, right? Rav Kook's famous line. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful night and everybody be well. We look forward to learning with you tomorrow soon. And please, please, please invite a friend to come and join us. If you like these shiurim, that's our best and pretty much our only form of advertising. So That's maybe why it's our best form. No, we have Facebook, other things, but that really word of mouth is the best form of advertising. So please do invite a friend to come to this year, or any other this year, whatever. We look forward to learning with you and your friends. And even if you don't like them so much, you can still invite them. Invite them to the classes you don't like. The classes you don't like, you can invite the people you don't like, you know, whatever. Okay. All right. Lila, talk to
everybody. Thank you very much. Have a good night. Thank you.
My pleasure. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, really.
I'm wondering whether instead of saying ambiguous, you could say polysemous, as in polysemitic.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you said. What word did you say instead of ambiguous?
I'm saying that when Rabbi Sokolov says that Rashi is not ambiguous.
He's ambivalent.
And say that he's polysemous. And pun on that word, polysemous, saying polysemitic.
The truth is that in the literature you'll find multivalent, polyvalent, multivocal. Right? There are a variety of different ways to refer to it. But the problem is that ambiguous has a dictionary definition.
Yes, I understand.
And the dictionary definition of ambiguous is not what you would like it to be. It's not what I would like it to be. That's my problem. My problem is that my authority in all these things is Rabbi OED.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Very good. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments? Vavakasha? Otherwise, wish everybody a Laila Tov.
I think when you say ambiguous, it's that it doesn't. I think Rashi had an agenda, and ambiguous means you're leaving it more to, you know, everybody. They're all equally acceptable. And I think when Rashi brings in a midrash, he's choosing from among many midrashim. And he has a specific message that he wants to give across. It's not that they're all equally, you know, choose one that you want. He has chosen for us the message that he wants to convey. It's not ambiguous means, you know, choose this, choose that. It's all parva. I don't think it's so neutral when Rashi is choosing this or that. Well, when he says davar acher, I think each one is chosen by him to convey a certain message.
Ambiguous doesn't have to mean unclear. Like if you, but I like ambiguous is the Torah purposely wants you to have multiple different ways to interpret. If you want to, you know, for those who are at Rabbi Kowalski shared today when he talked about no names, how the Torah purposely has no names, you know, in Perek Beit and Shmot, which is interesting. You quoted that Rashi today, you know, from Perek Beit on Bat Paro, no names. The idea is that we have to put ourselves into the story. It's a Torah purpose because it's not about what it happened. It's about for us, for all time. So the Torah wants us to put our name into it. That to me also lends into ambiguity because everybody's different. Everybody puts in their own personality. So the Torah has to allow itself to be interpreted in multiple ways in order to allow sort of each person to find it. So the Torah writes things in a way like, if I can say the first shir on Nechama Leibowitz, who was, of course, of the big belief that Rashi only quotes a midrash if it fits the pshat. I mean, I don't think you mentioned that in a specific way, Dr. Sokolov, but she's the champion of that view that Rashi only quotes if it's, I remember, I think the first class I had with her when I had the pleasure of learning with her and when I was in the Gros Kollel. So she said, when God approaches Kayin, what did you do? So Kayin says, Gadol Avoni means so. So to Machloka, Rashi Ramban, what did he say? Did he say Gadol Avoni means so? Gadol Avoni means so? Did he say it as a statement or a question? And the Torah, if he said it as a statement, so he's admitting guilt. If he said it as a question, he's not. Well, what's the big deal? What did I do? Is my sin so great to bear? Right off the bat. And because the Torah couldn't care less about Kain and Hevel, which is exactly why Rashi will say, Yesh Midrashim Harbei, but I'm not going to interpret the Pshat. Because the Midrashim are not talking about why Kain killed Hevel. They were fighting about woman, about land, about the territory, whatever. The Midrash has three explanations there. So, because the Torah is talking to us. It's not who cares about Kain and Hevel. So therefore, you know, The Torah writes it in a way where you can interpret it A or B. We don't really care, and we have no way of knowing, obviously, what Cain's tone of voice was when he responded. But the Torah couldn't care less about that. The Torah wants for us. So sometimes people say it as a question and sometimes as a statement. That I think I read that in the article. I wrote a long time ago, and I just quickly, remembered it. So I just threw it out there. But
an appendix to Iyunim Chadashim B'Sefer Shmot.
Which, the one I just said now?
No, by Nechama. Right. It's called the Darko Shel Rashi Bahava'at Midrashei Chazal.
Yeah. It's right in this book, too.
Torah Insights.
Right here. It's in this book, Torah Insights. And she has a great article on, what's it called here? Rashi's
Only because it's you and me. Look at the first page of that book, not the title page.
Okay, Nachman Torah Insights. Oh, no, not the title page. All right, Yizerv Ben Sion Hadar. I'm looking for your name here. It's a call for justice. How to read a chapter? What am I missing? Only because it's you and me.
It's on the right hand side. It's like an acknowledgement.
I don't see it, and maybe I have an older version.
No. Go, just pass the table of contents.
Pass the table of contents. Okay. Asher Tumshinoff. Let me read it. Hold on. The last three essays presented in this volume have been published previously in the USA by Torah and Education Network in a translation by Moshe Sokolow.
They went ahead and published my work and put somebody else's name on the cover of the book.
Eleanor Library. Yeah, this is a great book. But anyways, this is when I read it, I don't know if I ever read this page, but I said Moshe Sokolow, it didn't mean much at the time, but now, of course, when you know the people. But you didn't translate the article on the Midrashim of Rashi. That's not one of the last three.
I did.
Oh, it is. Oh, that's the one. Right. Oh, that's the third last one. So you translated. Wow, that's pretty good. 42 pages. That's a lot of work.
I did a whole book called Teaching Tanakh.
That's a lot of work. Yeah, I see.
A whole book, a translation of a whole bunch of essays by Nechama Leibovitz. I even did a translation of one, strangely enough, but fascinating, Nechama Leibovitz on how to teach Jewish history.
I wish Nechama, here, I'll get one more book here. Nechama. This other book that people don't know about, Limudei Parshanei Torah,
V'Horatam.
Right. So this, as far as you know, is not in English. I don't know. Has it been translated into English? Has not been. Okay. But I wish she had I'll end with this. It's funny. I wish she had on Shmuel and Vayikra. When we had her, so before Purim, we asked her to give us a shiur on Megillat Esther. We were learning all year. Mondays, 1:30 to 3, come every day, whatever her style. And she said, I can't teach. I don't know the Megillah well enough. I was like, what are you? I mean, she doesn't know the Megillah well enough, then I can't teach anything. Like she doesn't know the Megillah well. I'm like, I don't know what 2 + 2 = 4 is. She unbelievable. So she wouldn't give a shiur on Megillat Esther. She said she can't teach it well enough. She also told us she doesn't know Gemara, which is also ridiculous because she looks up every Gemara, but she never systematically learned Gemara, but she knows Gemara. She was an amazing woman. Those who had the pleasure of ever meeting her, she really changed the world. Nechama was an amazing, amazing woman. Anyways, okay, everybody, I'll let you go. It's late, and thank you for staying on. And, I'm sorry?
I just sent you my ambiguity.
Are you sending me on ambiguity? Where did you send me?
I emailed it to you.
Oh, you emailed it to me. Okay, fine. Okay, great.
Hey, I had Nechama Leibovitz for Chumash before your time.
At Hebrew U?
At some kind of seminar. And she always said, Ma Kashel L'Rashi.
Right, that's Ma Kashel L'Rashi. Ma Kashel L'Rashi. And you had to write down on the thing that she would check it.
You had to write it on these little papers she gave you.
Two-thirds. No, we would write on two-thirds of the paper, and she would use the one-third of the side paper to mark. Lo nachon.
Check or X,
lo nachon. Lo nachon.
Lo nachon. Lo nachon. Lo nachon. He'd walk up and down the aisle.
Yeah. Nachon. Yeah. And she was a great pedagogue. Great, right. Great pedagogue.
And she knew every cab driver. They all knew.
Yeah, because she talked. And yeah, she was an amazing woman. People, thank God, I had the pleasure.
It was a real schuss to learn with her. Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. Anyways, okay. There's more. We can continue tomorrow, everybody. Hope to see you soon. And now for sure, invite a friend. You see, that's it. This is the best part of the Shira, no? Dr. Sokol, no, this is
both,
the most
both fun. Were pretty good.
No, okay. I meant it as, you know, like, okay. Bye,
thank
everybody.
You. Thank you. Kulta, stay well.
Okay, Kulta, bye-bye.